Hello and welcome to Dialects from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also to listeners on Radio Verulam in St Albans. Our guest this week is Graham Fisher. Graham lived on the streets for 6 months, but now he's set up a very enterprising sewing workshop in the St Paul's area of Bristol, and we'll be chatting to him about that.
We've two features from Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Alec Milne reads the 11th part of The Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, has a new poem especially for dialect, and Jeff Sparks is here with, as usual, with his What's On Guide. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
But first, a song to start the show. It's the Sewing Machine song. It has an amazing 138,602 downloads, apparently, which is pretty something. It's an old Hollywood movie about the rag trade that this is from.
The sewing machine, a girl's best friend. If I didn't have my sewing machine, I'd have come to no good end. But a bobbin, a bobbin, a pedal, and wheel, the wheel by day. So by night, I feel so weary that I never get out to play. Oh, the sewing machine, the sewing machine, a friend in need.
With us today, we have Graham Fisher from Sewing Communities Together. Hi, Graham.
Good evening.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So tell us a bit more about your initiative in St Paul's.
Yeah, sure. It's called Sewing Communities Together. It's a free service that myself and other people in the local community are putting together to provide sewing materials and machines and training and skills for those people who are currently homeless or have experienced being homeless, people who come from vulnerable backgrounds and also on low income. They can come along and get to learn how to use a sewing machine and make their own clothes, soft furnishings. We've had people who've come along who are homeless repair their own rucksacks. We're happy to for people if they use sleeping bags to repair the sleeping bags, same with tents, anything really which will improve that person's life.
And did you set this initiative up?
I did, yes.
And so how did you go about that?
Well, I was homeless for a period of 6 months, and during that time I was grateful enough to be able to use the clothing handout stores from various homeless charities. The situation I found with myself is because I lost nearly 3 stone, a lot of the clothes which were handed out to me wouldn't fit. They'd either be too wide or too long. So I looked around Bristol to try and find a free service which would be run by homeless organisations, agencies, where I could just go along on a drop-in basis, have the use of a sewing machine and a little bit of guidance to be able to take up and take in my trousers. I couldn't find anywhere, which was quite upsetting really, because I also knew of quite a lot of other people in the same situation and circumstances who would have benefited from such a service. I just happened to go along to the Arnold Feeney to an exhibition called the Anti-Factory Exhibition, which was focusing and highlighting the situation with sweatshop factories. There was a hands-on part of the exhibition where they just had 2 sewing machines set up, a pile of clothing which had been donated from a charity shop, and a shopping bag pattern and a hoodie scarf pattern. And you could just choose material, choose a pattern, and with the guidance of the staff, go through all the stages and make a bag and a hoodie scarf. After a few hours, I produced such things. Never been on a sewing machine before. And suddenly realised that I couldn't find the services out there. I've just made garments. Therefore, I'm going to do the service myself. If it's not out there, I'm going to do it. On the realisation of just the very simple and basic minimum amount of equipment and materials and guidance you need to actually better your own circumstances. So off I went around Bristol, sourcing materials, machines, all for free, donation in kind. The hardest thing I found was getting a venue. I kept going around. People kept saying to me, unless you're an official organisation, nobody will be able to offer you the venue space because you're not transparent.
What did that mean? I mean, I suppose that must have been kind of odd for you.
It is, yeah. Well, it was. I mean, I just used to knock on doors of an agency, see the plaque outside, which would tell me they work within the sort of the homeless sector. And I would knock on the door, somebody would answer, and I'd say, hello, my name's Graham. I've been homeless, and I've sort of seen an opportunity to provide a service for those people who've been through similar situations. And they would ask me, where are you from? And I'd say, well, I'm from Nottingham originally. And they'd say, no, what organisation are you from? And I'd say, I'm not. I'm just a guy who was experienced being homeless with an idea. And a lot of doors were closed on me because I wasn't part of an organisation. Therefore, they didn't know who I was, and which I thought was quite diabolical, to be honest with you. I knocked on the door of a wonderful organisation, which is called Rethink, who work with people who have or encounter severe mental illness. They're based on City Road in St Paul's. A lovely lady called Jackie Boyce, who's a facilitation manager there, opened the door to me and had a quick chat with me. She saw and recognised what I wanted to do, and she offered the project 4-hour space, free of charge, every Thursday from 12 o'clock till 4 o'clock.
Where's the venue for that?
On City Road, okay, in St Paul's. It's called the St Paul's Settlement. Up on the traffic lights on City Road. And what I wanted to be able to do, once I started to understand about the model, should we say, of the third sector charitable community organisations, I didn't want to go down the funding route, because I believe that if there's an issue within a community, that I think that, and I'm proving and showing, that if everybody in a community from different sectors, such as business, agencies of charitable status, all donate little things, we can actually start to work to change people's individual circumstances. So we don't use a penny of funding. We're unemployed at the moment, so we're all learning skill sets. We have people who come along and we teach them introduction to the sewing machine, the functions of the sewing machine, basic stitching techniques. And on the back of that, we have genuinely helped genuine people in their genuine circumstances. We have asked for people who have got other sewing skills to come along to teach us and share, you know, skill share with us all. So if any of your listeners would like to come and help us, we just ask them to get in touch. We've got an email address, which is sewingcommunitiestogether@hotmail.co.uk. Any donations of fabrics, any haberdashery equipment is always welcome. What we'd also like to do is, once we're more confident with our skills, we'd like to be able to open it up across the city. We've had interest from St Stephen's Church, which is the city church, who would like us to be able to go along one session a week so they can invite people in their parish to go along and benefit from the service. So we'd like to really get it out across Bristol. And from doing a bit of research, it seems that there's a lack across the whole country of such service. What we would like to be able to do is for everybody, including myself, who comes along and participates in the service, to be able to improve our own circumstances and improve our well-being, for those who are unemployed, find employment, improve our general well-being, but also, as the project's titled, we'd like to be able to sew communities together. So anybody who's got any skills who would like to come along and share it with us are more than welcome to do so.
So how long have your sessions been going on then in St Paul's? How many people have you had kind of through the door, as it were?
Well, we started in February, one afternoon a week. What we've done so far, to keep it very easily manageable, we've been working on a one-to-one basis. So it's one, should we say, coordinator, and one, as I'm understanding the jargon, service user who's been coming along. One of the other things we are really proud to be able to say is John Lewis, the retailers, heard about the service we're trying to run and approached me to say that they were really inspired by my story and really would like to get involved to be able to help the project take off. They asked me to put a wish list together, which I did, and they kindly donated to us a £300 sewing machine through their corporate responsibility programme. I keep in regular contact with John Lewis, and we are going to get a visit from them. Their community coordinator is going to come along on April the 14th to the St Paul settlement on City Road to actually see the sewing machine in use, that it's not just sat in a cupboard collecting dust, and all the wonderful things the sewing machine is producing and the positive effect it's having on absolutely everybody who comes into contact with it. We hope to set the project up so it is an official project. We would like to be able to work towards it becoming a charitable status. We would also like to be able to set it up as a social enterprise so we become self-sustainable. We would ideally in the future like to see us all, those who are able to gain employment on the back of it, do so. We would also like to be able to, if possible, on the self-sustainable side, the social enterprise side, we're thinking of making Christmas seasonal gifts, Christmas tree decorations, Christmas stockings, those type of things, and sell them around certain venues around Bristol to be able to support financially the project. I've got other little ideas in the pipeline, but again, if anybody out there has got any business knowledge who would like to come along and help and guide us, we need to set up a committee. So again, we're looking for committee members who would be willing to come along and help in any way. We'd also like for the future to be able to finance workshop space, workshop units. So anybody who is in my position, who's got an idea and just wants the opportunity to see if it works to benefit the community and the people within it, offer them free space so they can go along and trial it for a few months.
Brilliant. So could you just repeat your email address one more time?
It's sewingcommunitiestogether@hotmail.co.uk.
Brilliant.
We've also just mentioned we've had a website which has been set up by a lovely girl called Jess Harlin. The website is sewingcommunitiestogether.tk.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Graham. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's one of Bristol's best kept secrets and a historic building. It was a world recognised milestone in the Industrial Revolution. Well, what am I talking about? Tucked away just outside the Ring Road in Warmley is Kingswood Heritage Museum. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to its boss, Alan Bryant.
We're inside Kingswood Heritage Museum, which is on the eastern fringes of Bristol. In fact, it's actually in Warmley, but it's called Kingswood Museum because it covers the former Kingswood Borough areas, which is Hannam, Mangotsfield, Downend, Wick and Bitton. There's probably per square mile as much history in Kingswood as in Bristol. You know, we have the site where we are. We're in some very old buildings, which was the earliest part of the Industrial Revolution. A chap called William Champion came to Warmley, set up a brassworks at Warmley, which became the largest in the country. He was the first person to manufacture zinc in Europe. On the site, he built a windmill tower, which is still surviving and is the oldest and tallest windmill tower left in the country. Also on this site, there is an ice house, which we can't get into, but that was the biggest Georgian ice house in the country. Around the gardens, he built himself quite an extensive estate and created a 13.5-acre lake. And in the centre of the lake, he built a statue of Neptune that is about 30 foot tall, which is the largest garden statue in the country. There's also some largest man-made grotto in the country. All these things happened on the eastern edge of the Bristol community in what was at that particular time the lawless Kingswood area.
Why do you say that? Why lawless?
Because the Kingswood colliers were renowned throughout the empire as being unmanageable. John Wesley came to Kingswood to preach to the miners in the open fields at Hannam Mount, where the green beacon light is. He came to speak to them in the open fields because he knew that they wouldn't go to the churches, and he wanted to convert them. Another famous Kingswood celebrity was a chap called George Whitfield, who built the Whitfield Tabernacle, which was the second earliest Methodist church in the country, and that was built at Kingswood. And he later went to America to evangelize, and he was being told, why go to America to preach to the savages? Try and convert the heathens of Kingswood. So that's why I say, in this unruly part of the country, the Kingswood Colliers were literally a race unto themselves. They were really desperate people who worked a desperate job underground in the dark, no safety, no sanitation. Life expectancy was low. It was a terrible job, but somebody had to do it.
I suppose they didn't really like being bossed around if they were working in such difficult conditions.
But also, there was no kind of religious father figure in Kingswood itself. There wasn't a Kingswood church. The nearest church was at Bitton, and even the one at St. George was not even built at that particular time. So then you would have Pippin Jay, which was probably the next nearest church to the Kingswood Colliers. And the people who lived in the Kingswood Forest, first of all, the forest area, were basically squatters. They moved in there, and if they could build a house with a fire ablaze in the hearth by the morning, that gave them rights to stay there. Not that you can do that these days. That's how everybody come into Kingswood Forest or some of the woods around Kingswood trying to claim squatters' rights. But that's what you could do in those days. It is a local history museum, but the front edge is the William Champion story, which is the buildings were his buildings, and the grounds, you can come and walk around the grounds. They are public open space, and you can walk up to Neptune. It is all in the grounds. The museum has various rooms. There's about six rooms. One of the rooms is dedicated to Douglas motorbikes. And later on in the year, we hold the Douglas Cavalcade from the museum. But when the museum opens, somebody will be able to provide a cup of tea and some light refreshments. The museum itself is open all year round from March through to December, every Tuesday. And throughout the summer season, we're open on every Sunday as well. So it's a Tuesday and a Sunday throughout the summer. Summer season starts the 1st of May, so the museum is open only on the second Sunday of the month. So you can come on the second Sunday of the month or on a Tuesday and have a cup of tea and see some of this remarkable history that's on your doorstep.
But you're quite tucked away here. What's the easiest way to find you?
If you can get onto the Ring Road, coming out from Bristol, you turn off at the Deanery Road roundabout, head towards Keynsham and turn off at the first roundabout that you come to, and it's marked Oldland. There is a brown sign on that roundabout.
Thank you to Alan Bryant there, chairman of one of Bristol area's historic treasures, the Kingswood Heritage Museum in Warmley. And he was talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. If you want to go there by bus, numbers 43 between Cadbury Heath and Bristol City Centre via Kingswood, as well as the 319 from Cribbs Causeway via the UWE to Bath. So that's the 43 and the 319. They both go past that museum. Well, in the spirit of mystery, here's an interview in which we cannot state any of the names involved. Quite mysterious. Why would that be? Well, it was recorded in Central America in Antigua. The following interview, it's an interview with a soldier who was involved in the Civil War. So I've got a bit of background and a bit of history about Guatemala for you as a bit of an introduction to this interview with this soldier, so that you can understand some of what he's talking about and why it's important. It's a reminder of the legacy left in the aftermath of Civil War. In this case, Civil War, which was started in Guatemala in the 1970s, after left-wing guerrilla groups had started to form in the 1960s. Guatemala industry developed fast during this period in the 60s, but the profits from the boom flowed upwards. Labour unions were as a consequence formed, and migration to the cities, especially to the capital, Guatemala City, produced urban sprawls and slums. A cycle of violent repression and protest took hold there, leading to total politicisation of society, with the rural poor fighting the urban elite. Well, by the late 70s and 79, Amnesty estimated that between 50,000 and 60,000 people had died in political violence of the 70s. During the 1980s, four disparate guerrilla groups united to form the Guatemala National Revolutionary Unity, known as URNG. Military suppression of anti-government elements began in the countryside, where huge numbers of people, mostly indigenous men, were murdered in the name of anti-insurgency, stabilisation and anti-communism. Guatemalans refer to this scorched earth strategy as La Escoba, the broom, because of the way the reign of terror swept over the country. The government attacked the bases of the rebels, usually in poor, rural, indigenous areas. In order to kill off support for the rebels, they razed 400 villages and massacred or tortured most of the inhabitants. It is estimated 15,000 people died and 100,000 Mayan refugees fled over the border into Mexico. The government forced villagers to form the patrullas de autodefensa civil, or the civil defence patrols, to do much of the army's dirty work, which are responsible for the worst of the human rights abuses during the presidency of General Efrén Ríos Montt. The civil war, as they do tend to, dragged on, with both sides committing atrocities. Although the country returned to democratic rule in 86, when Marco Vinicio Cerezo Arevalo of the Christian Democratic Party took office, armed conflict still festered in remote areas, and many people thought no real progress had been made at all. From 90 to 93, massacres and other human rights abuses continued under the new president, Jorge Saranto, from the conservative Movimiento de Acción Solidaria, or the Solidarity Action Movement. Finally, on December the 29th, 96, a firm and lasting peace agreement was signed between the government, led by the president, Alvaro Arzu, and the left-wing guerrilla movement, URNG. During the 36 years of civil war, an estimated 200,000 Guatemalans had been killed, a million made homeless, and untold thousands had disappeared. Any hopes for a truly just and democratic society have looked increasingly frayed as the years have passed since 96, however. The major problems are poverty, illiteracy combined with lack of education and poor medical facilities, and these remain a very long way from being solved. The major concern for all Guatemalans is mainly that of security. Gang violence continues to haunt Guatemala City, with the city bus drivers who fail to pay extortionists being the most common targets. Violence against women has also long been a concern in the country, where many murders go unresolved. So, in the following interview, recorded last month, we hear from a former soldier who took part in the civil war in El Salvador. He talks about civil war in Central America and the legacy of the gangs, or the maras. This week we hear part one of the interview, followed by a reaction from a fellow traveller about the current situation in Guatemala City. The music that's been chosen for this feature is from CD El Pabanc, excuse my pronunciation if that's wrong, spelled P-A-A-B-A-N-C, from the suite Indigena Folklorica, performed by Marimba Herencia Maya Quiche, and the tune is called Danza de la Guacamayas.
Salvador, and I was involved in civil war several years ago.
So how old were you when the civil war started?
I was about 17 or 16 years old.
Can you tell us what happened?
Well, the first thing that I remember is we were marching against the government with some people from the university. I was studying in high school. So we were marching in a main avenue. Then the Guardia Nacional was step in front of us. We were about 2,000 students, and then they were about 100 guardias. When they stopped us, we tried to continue, but they used the force to stop us. They start beating the people who was in front of the march, and after that, I just heard shotguns and grenades, and I ran.
Were many people killed?
I heard, but I didn't see anyone. I heard there were about 20 people died, more than 100 injured.
Was that the catalyst that started the war then, the demonstration?
Yes, it was the event that it was like a spark, flaming the fuel.
Was it building up quietly behind the scenes?
Well, it was a response for many years of abuse from the government, from the police, from the rich people who was managing the government. Actually, in that days, the government was military government, and they were always put by the people who controlled everything. The president was a colonel. So it was the event that finished all the patience that the people has been supporting.
So how long did the war go on for?
About 20 years. At the very beginning, there were not many people involved, you know. There were cells of small groups.
Like guerrilla activity?
Not much like guerrillas. More likely people who was teaching the students and the other people to know what went wrong and what was happening. After that, because of the event that I already told, the people started to fight, screaming against the military parades, screaming against the government, screaming in meetings against government, and it was reaching a lot of people.
You said that you had a particularly bad experience during the Civil War. Can you tell us about that?
The worst experience that I had was when the guerrillas was fighting against the army. I was going back home from the work, and I stuck in the middle of the shootings, and I threw myself underneath a car. When everything finished, I started to walk, and I saw around 25 dead people.
Civilians?
Children, women, boys, because we were just in the middle of the fight. At the very beginning, the government was really being hard against the guerrillas, and they didn't forgive a life. Once they knew a people was involved with them, they killed them. But at the same time, the guerrillas did the same. Because if the guerrillas got a soldier, they torture him and they kill him. It was happening in both parties. We were hopeless in the middle of the battle. It was increasing day by day. I can remember another time when I was again in the middle of a shooting. I tried to escape from the house that I was living to a safer house. Now, when I was out of the street with my boys in my arms. A soldier was just in front of me, and he was scared about me. And he just pointed at me with his gunshot, almost killed me. Just because he saw the boys with myself, he didn't shot.
Many of your friends and family killed?
Friends, yes, a lot of them. My brother was involved with the guerrillas. He was working with a group who demolished a big bridge in El Salvador. He had to escape to Canada, and he's been living there 25 years. So I can say I know how I see it.
Tell us about the problem with the children, the orphan children.
Because when the army went to look for the guerrillas in the countryside, they got everyone in there, and they, if they knew that there were guerrillas, they killed everybody. Everybody. They didn't forgive anyone. The babies just get abandoned with nobody to take care about them. They were taken by good people or by relatives or parents or from their own family. But another ones were just abandoned there, and the guerrillas took them to increase their army. No matter if they were 7, 8, or 10 years old, they teach them how to use the shotguns, pistols, rifles, everything, and they get into the army of the guerrilla.
What happened after that?
When the war finished, because the guerrilla and the government agreed...
A treaty.
A treaty, yes. When it was signed off, they were finished. But all these kids that I just talked about didn't know do anything. They didn't go to school. They were involved in the civil war during 5 or 10 years. So they cannot do anything. They didn't know about the family. They didn't know anything about love or about respect or any other value. When they didn't do anything to do, they went to the United States following the American dream. And when they were there, they get involved with mobs, and they learn how to arrange a group, how to manage it. They learned how to organize a gang. And they were involved in the gangs in the States several years also. When the United States government realized what was happening, they sent them back to El Salvador.
So what's happening in El Salvador at the moment?
Not just in El Salvador. The problem grow bigger because when they go back to El Salvador, they started to run their own mob. They call it Mara Salvatrucha or Mara 18 or Mara 13. Names they get in the United States from the name of the streets they were living. For instance, Mara 18, they were living in the 18th Street in Los Angeles. Mara 13, they were living in the 13th Avenue in the United States. Mara Salvatrucha, they call it Salvatrucha because all Salvadorian were called Salvatrucha, with it has its own meaning for the Mexican people who also speak Spanish and English. Salvatrucha means Salvador or Salvadorian. Trucha means a people who can do anything. And so they started these gangs in El Salvador. At the moment, if I'm not wrong, there are about 100,000 people involved in the Maras in El Salvador, but they are also in Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and probably in Costa Rica.
Is it just in the big cities that the problems occur?
Mostly in the big cities, where they can get anything. They can sell anything, they can do anything. if they control an area in any city, you cannot go through. If you want to go through, you can be injured or you can be beat, or you have to pay to go through their areas.
So why don't the police put a stop to it?
It is a huge problem in all Central America. The police cannot control them. And many policemen are involved with them. They, I can say, control everything. Everything. When I mean everything, I mean everything. They control big areas, a lot of people. They control drugs. They control many things. It is amazing how they are involved in a lot of things.
Waiting outside a hotel in the city centre, Guatemala City. We're in the shuttle bus to Antigua. Suzanne, what have you thought so far? Tell us what you've seen.
I'm really scared sat here. There's just chaps walking around with guns, shotguns. I don't think I've ever felt so frightened and vulnerable in my life ever.
So what happened when we left the hostel?
Straight into the car. Just driving, we had to go through barriers to get out of a zone.
It was police, wasn't it?
Police barriers, yeah, with shotguns sat in the front of the car. Even our driver's got a gun in the car. I should be glad to get out of this city and feel a bit safer.
But actually, driving round, it is a lovely city, isn't it? It's a shame. You see really nice bars, trees.
You see them, but you hardly see anybody on the streets, though. Where the zone that we came out of, it was just peopleless. This is a bit busier. But you just see casually walking up the road with shotguns thrown over the shoulders and down by the sides. Scary.
And that was a report from Central America, from Guatemala, no less. And the music was the Danza de los Gourmets from the CD El Pabank.
And now here is Alec Milne to read the 11th part of the Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest Mayhew. The music is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia, and the voice of Stevenson's mother is Vivian Kynaston.
Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 11, 5 months in Hawaii, January to June 1889. Thank you. The Casco had a difficult journey from Tortira to Honolulu and was delayed by about 2 weeks. They were becalmed for several days within sight of land, living on short rations as food supplies ran out. Stevenson's mother recorded their arrival on Thursday, 24th January.
At last we passed through the reef and cast anchor in Honolulu Harbour at 3:30 p.m. Joe and Belle and Austin come on board at once, and Belle takes hysterics when she finds it really is her mother. She had boarded two wrong yachts before. Louis goes straight to the Hawaiian Hotel to see his letters. I go with Belle to her house, and we all dine at the hotel, Captain too. It seems to us the finest meal we have ever eaten.
Joe and Belle Strong and their son Austin, by now 8 years old, had lived in Honolulu since September 1882. The Stevenson party joined the Strongs at 40 Emma Street, the home of Henry F. Poor and his mother, Mrs. Caroline Bush, where they were staying. A few days later, on 27th January, in search of greater peace and quiet, Arwales and Fanny moved to Poor's bungalow, Manuia Lanai, at Waikiki, about 3 miles out of Honolulu. Waikiki was then a country district of rice fields, coconut groves, a white sandy beach and a few scattered summer residences. The Strongs and their friends were members of the royal set surrounding Kalakaua, the last king of Hawaii. David Kalakaua, 1836-1891, a chief who was elected king in 1874, had fought a losing battle for political power against the Reform Missionary Party, dominated by American business interests, and the Bayonet Constitution of 1887 had shorn him of most of his authority. The struggle was to end in 1893 with the deposition of his sister and successor, Queen Liliʻiō Kalani, and annexation by the United States at the end of the century. Despite the corruption and scandal that characterized his regime, Kalaua himself was a man of great personal charm and ability, deeply interested in Hawaiian history and legend. Arwales was later to describe him as an amiable, far from unaccomplished, but too convivial sovereign. Arwales and Lloyd were formally presented to the king at Iolani Palace on 26th January, and they spent that afternoon at the king's boathouse, where they were adorned with wreaths, drank champagne, played whist, and had their photographs taken. The king visited the Casco on the afternoon of the 1st of February. He was given champagne, sherry and cake. Arwales read Ticonderoga. Captain Otis played the accordion, Belle danced, and Lloyd sang The Dolls of Peru, a poem written by Arwales in Tahiti. 2 days later, Henry Poor gave a luau, or feast, in honour of Arwales, with the king and princess as their chief guests. Fanny presented the king with a golden pearl, and Arwales read the specially written poem to Kalakaua. Stevenson and the king were soon on friendly terms, and the king tried very hard to persuade Arwales to settle in Hawaii. As early as 2nd of February, Arwales had decided to send the Casco back to San Francisco. On 5th of February, his mother noted in her diary, "Louis finds that he can hire at the house next to the Mr. Poor's at Waikiki for a few months, so he determines to send away the Casco and settle down here and make a little money to take us home." At this period, letters took a week to reach San Francisco, a further week to cross the States to New York, and about 10 days to cross the Atlantic to London or Edinburgh. There were usually two deliveries and collection of mail in Honolulu each month by regular mail steamers. To Charles Baxter. Postmark, 8th March 1889, Honolulu. My dear Charles, Lloyd and I have finished a story, The Wrong Box. If it is not funny, I'm sure I don't know what is. I have split over writing it. Since I've been here, I've been toiling like a galley slave. 3 numbers of The Master to rewrite, 5 chapters of The Wrong Box to write and rewrite, and about 500 lines of a narrative poem to write, rewrite, and re-rewrite. Now I have The Master waiting for me in its continuation. 2 numbers more. When that is done, I shall breathe. This spasm of activity has been checkered with champagne parties, happy and glorious. Hawaii, Ponoi, Nana, I, Ku, Moi. Native Hawaiians dote upon their monarch. Hawaiian, God save the king. In addition to my other labours, I am learning the language with a native Monshi. Kalakaua is a terrible companion. A bottle of fizz is like a glass of sherry to him. He thinks nothing of 5 or 6 in the afternoon as a whet for dinner. Look here, Van Laan, Edmonstone, Charles Mackay and Sam Buff. He could have taken all four, one up and another down. As for you, you poor creature, he could settle you before breakfast. You should see a photograph of our party after an afternoon with HHM. My, what a crew! The proud drunkenness of Lloyd, the soppy swan-neckery of RLS. My mother, let us draw a veil till I see you. Yours affectionately, Robert Louis Stevenson. To Sidney Colvin, early June 1889, Honolulu. My dear Colvin, I have seen sights that cannot be told and heard stories that cannot be repeated, yet I never admired my poor race so much, nor, strange as it may seem, loved life more than in the settlement. A horror of moral beauty broods over the place. That's like bad Victor Hugo, but it is the only way I can express the sense I've lived with all these days. And even though it is in great part Catholic, my sympathies never flew with so much difficulty as towards Catholic virtues. The passbook kept with heaven stirs me to anger and laughter. One of the sisters calls the place the ticket office to heaven. Well, what is the odds? They do their dark, and do it with kindness and efficiency incredible. And we must take folks' virtues as we find them, and love the better part. Of old Damien, whose weakness is worse, perhaps I've heard fully, I think only the more. It was a European peasant, dirty, bigoted, untruthful, unwise, tricky, but superb with generosity, residual candour and fundamental good humour. Convince him he had done wrong, it might take a few hours of insult, and he would undo what he had done, and like his corrector better. A man with all the grime and paltriness of mankind, but a saint and a hero, all the more for that. The place's regard scenery is grand, gloomy and bleak, mighty mountain walls descending sheer along the whole face of the island into a sea unusually deep, the front of the mountain ivied and furred with clinging forest, one verdescent cliff about halfway from east to west, the low, bare, stony promontory edged in between the cliff and the ocean, the two little towns, Kalaweo and Kalauapapa, seated on the other side of it, bear almost as bathing machines upon the beach, and the population, gorgons and chimeras dire. All of this tear of the nerves I bore admirably. Remember me to Mrs. Sitwell, Henry James, who is a good fellow indeed, and a man that I find one grows to love, and William Archer if you see him. It is strange, I think, that these are the best of my London friends, and both, the men I mean, quite new. Oh, I didn't mean to exclude Meredith or Lang, and say something kind to Goss. Poverino. Here is a lot of copy. I will shut up for the meantime. RLS.
Many thanks to Alec Milner for reading the 11th part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. We've had a slight delay in the recording of Treasure Island, which Alec's been recording those letters in honour of. That will be read by Malcolm Grieve when we get it, and hopefully it will be with us by next month.
Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, is here in the studio. Hello.
Hello, John.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Excellent. Fine. You're in good fine fettle.
Indeed.
Okay, what poetry have you got for us this week?
This is a follow-up poem to the Arabian Eruption that I did 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Ah, excellent. So it's of a topical nature.
Oh, cutting edge. Yes.
Cutting edge.
In the moment.
That's what we like. It's an exclusive for dialect. Excellent.
Notes on the Arab Spring.
Okay.
As we speak, this is how it is. Tunisia was first to fall. Now are the bricks itch in the wall. The walls of fear and repression that locks a nation in depression are crumbling. So now, as we speak, the meek no longer look so weak. And people ask, where will it end? While the commentators don't pretend we can predict where that will be, there are degrees of being free. And democracy's not an either-or. One can have less of it or more. Our island's not that democratic. But neither is it that dogmatic. we err towards the compromise, as that's where our tradition lies. And although our empire is long gone, we still hear the echo of its song, and so we are apt to interfere in foreign conflicts far from here. Due to unpredictability, some say that we should wait and see, avoid involvement in the foreign scraps, which they perceive as hopeless scraps. While others say we can't stand by observing innocents who die upon our screens, while we sit here and try, but fail to feel their fear. Of those who fight to free their lands of tyrants, no one understands, and sleep uneasy in their beds, unsettled by what's in the heads of those who fight to overthrow those old regimes we've come to know, and psychopaths who, in their last hour, prefer a massacre to losing power.
The Bard of Wimber Hill, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Well, it's time for Jeff Sparks, who, as usual, has come dressed in his rather slightly eccentric guitar of Pink Apron and Yellow Sou'wester, but nevertheless he is here with the Watson Guide for this week. Hello.
Hello, this is a Watson Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 1st of April, Three Kings High will be performing with Sam Shaw and Gio Coma at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is £3.50 on the door. On Saturday, 2nd of April, Mentallica will be performing with support from Higher On Maiden at Fiddler's in Railway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Three Kings High. This group hail from Bristol, and even though their music is rooted in hip-hop, they also combine it with soulful indie melodies. This is from their four-track single, and it's a track titled Tell 'Em Lies.
He's following false idols. Looks the image and wants to be like him. Stops studying to spend his night times hiding. Now a disciple, carrying the knife, getting advice and making all the little girls cry. But the truth is, he's a family guy with a wife, a child, and a girl. And well, he buys them. And the cars are rental, and there's aren't real diamonds. And his real name's Nigel. Hand on the Bible. Please, little Billy, open your eyes and realize this guy's a liar.
Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him?
Said he was a big shot. Guess I should have gone a minute too. If he's winning with the women, then he hit them. Then he's thinking it don't matter if it's really true. And if he's never getting busted, well then everything is gravy. And the ladies that he's lusting, they're trusting, and they ain't finding out about his missus and his baby. But he works in the warehouse, which are really under shaming. But he lives above his means when he's living on his dreams, and it's seeming that the dreams are all fading. And he's missing on his mortgage, and the missus he was bored with left the home, gave his on his own, feeling pretty silly because he's knowing that he really can't afford it.
Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him lies? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him lies?
The truth is the truth hurts and it sticks. Loose lips that do dirt, the sun shifts. Wise guys and white lies to tell tales. The fine line between his heaven and your hell. Truth is the truth hurts and mud sticks. Loose lips that do dirt, the sun shifts. Wise guys and white lies to tell tales. The fine line between his heaven and your hell.
Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him lies? Why would you tell him? 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 Why would you tell him lies? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him? Why would you tell him lies?
That was Three Kings High with Tell 'Em Lies from their four-track single. For more information, you can check out www.threekingshigh.co.uk. Into Sunday, 3rd of April, Billy No Mates will be performing with support from Haxel and also Far Q in the front bar at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on Tuesday, 5th of April, Michael Munro will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
All right, thank you very much, Jeff. Be careful in his stilettos on the way out because obviously the ceiling is quite low. That's all from Dialect this week. Don't forget the Bristol Folk Festival is coming up at Colston Hall at the end of April. You can expect what you would get at an outdoor festival, except indoors, including, we are told, portaloos and fake grass inside Colston Hall. Looking forward to that. You can go to Google or your favourite search engine and look that up for more details. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Graham Fisher, from Sewing Communities Together. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling.
Alec Milne read the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. We had a poem from Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and we had What's On by Jeff Sparks. The engineer was Michael Noyce.
The presenters were John Peters Coleman
and Michaela Dennis.
So thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to having you again next week. The producer was Anthea Page.
Argentina. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every